Haïti Chérie by Kale featuring Emmeline Michel. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Haiti, the site of a horrific massacre this week. The leader of a powerful armed group in Haiti killed as many as 184 people in Cité Soleil, a neighborhood of Port-au-Prince. Most, if not all, the victims were elderly residents. According to one Haitian human rights group, the head of the Wharf Jérémie gang ordered the killings because he believed practitioners of voodoo had sickened his child. According to the United Nations, more than 5,000 people have been killed in Haiti this year as the country continues to face a spiraling political, humanitarian and security crisis. This is Wanja Karia of the World Food Program.
So the situation is getting much more critical. We've seen a growing number of internally displaced now getting to over 700,000 in the country. So the needs are huge.
Earlier this week, Human Rights Watch called for what it described as a full-fledged United Nations mission to Haiti. The group said, quote, the mission should ensure a human rights-based response to restore security, the rule of law, and democratic governance, unquote. We're joined now by Brian Concannon, human rights lawyer who serves as the executive director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. He's joining us from Boston. First of all, what do you understand happened this weekend, Brian? Almost 200 people slain in Cité Soleil. You have worked on the issue of Haiti for decades. Talk about what's happening today.
Well, thanks, Amy, for having me back. And thanks, as always, to Democracy Now! For covering Haiti. What's happening today is the continued devolution of Haiti that has, I mean, it's got causes going back 200 years, but the more proximate causes are that since 2012, the United States has propped up a political movement around the PHTK party that has dismantled Haiti's democracy and stolen its resources. And you have a situation like you had this weekend where gang leaders, because the state is absent from many areas of Cité Soleil, a gang leader was able to execute possibly 100 or more people because he was upset about his child being killed. And this is really the predictable result of dismantling democracy. And there were massacres before. You've covered the massacre, like the 2018 massacre in La Saline. And right after that, Maxine Waters went down and she said, unless this impunity is stopped, you're going to have more massacres. And we are having more massacres, and we will continue to have massacres until Haiti's allowed to establish a democratic government.
Can you talk about this all happening after Haiti's new transitional presidential council has been in place for about a month? What have they accomplished, and what's happening with the Kenyan force that's in?
Well, the presidential council, it's a little bit complicated. The presidential council, which is kind of acting as the president of Haiti, they've been in office since April. What happened in November was a new government, so that's a prime minister and ministers, was sworn in. The day that the prime minister was sworn in, gangs attacked areas that are strongholds of Haiti's popular resistance. They shot at airplanes. So it appears as if the gangs are not happy with the installation of the new government. In terms of the MSS force, which is a force authorized by the UN Security Council, but is explicitly not a UN force. So it's basically under the leadership of Kenya. That force has 432 members. It has been deployed since June. And it's important to note that 432 is far fewer than just the attrition of the Haitian police since the mission was deployed. It has not really been successful at having any sustained security improvements. There have been a few operations where the MSS mission, along with Haitian police, have been able to dislodge gangs from strategic areas. But typically when the MSS and Haitian police need to go elsewhere, then the gangs just come right back in, or the gangs just move on to another more vulnerable area.
I wanted to read a headline from the Miami Herald last week. Gang violence shut down Haiti's main airport. That hasn't stopped U.S. deportation flights. Deportation planes are now landing in Cap-Haïtien. That's Haiti's second largest city. So you have flights being shot at, yet still you have the U.S. deporting Haitians to Haiti right now.
Yes, and they're being placed in Cap-Haitien, and many of them are from other places, including Port-au-Prince. But there's no way to get safely to Port-au-Prince unless you have the money to rent a helicopter. And so it is absolutely indefensible to be sending people back to these conditions.
So what do you demand of the U.S. government?
What the U.S. government needs to do is to stop propping up the PHTK party and other undemocratic parties in Haiti. I talked to just after the U.S. election, I talked with my colleague Mario Joseph, who's Haiti's most prominent human rights lawyer. He was worried about what was going to happen in the U.S. with the new administration because of what you so well covered earlier in today's news. But he said it really doesn't make a difference for Haitians because we don't see a difference between Democratic and Republican administrations. And what he's talking about is really two centuries of U.S. policies that have prevented Haiti from having a strong, prosperous, and independent government. And what needs to happen is the U.S. needs to stop doing that. The U.S. actually, in fact, from about 1994 to 2000, we did allow democracy to work in Haiti, and democracy, in fact, worked. You had improvements in security, improvements in education, healthcare, the economy, across the board. But since 2004, when, again, Democracy Now! Covered this very well, the U.S. toppled Haiti's regime, we've continued to back undemocratic elements, and it has led to the very predictable disaster that we have now. What needs to change is the U.S. policy that does not want to allow Haiti to be free.
Now, you just briefed the U.S. Congressional Caribbean Caucus on Haiti. What are you calling on the Trump administration to do? Not only is President Trump talking about starting mass deportations on day one, but through the campaign, he and, well, now the Vice President-elect J.D. Vance have been talking about Springfield, Ohio, as ground zero, as the first place they'll start because of the large Haitian population.
Yes, the whole point of the rhetoric around Springfield, Ohio, was to demonize majority black immigrants as a way of exciting a base that gets excited by white supremacist rhetoric. The administration is going to continue to do that because it works. What needs to happen is the rest of us need to step up, and we need to step up by going into the streets, by protesting. We need to step up, and IJDH will do this as we did the last Trump administration. We'll go to court. People need to work within the political system, call their members of Congress. We need to resist on all fronts. And, you know, as discussed earlier in the segment, it's hard to predict exactly what's going to happen, but we can predict that there's going to be hate-inspired, race-based persecution. And the rest of us need to be ready to step up to stop that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Brian Kincannon, human rights lawyer, executive director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. He's speaking to us from Boston. Coming up, we look at the tragic deaths of two black men who were killed while experiencing mental health crises. The New York street performer, Michael Jackson impersonator, Jordan Neely, and the award-winning piano virtuoso, Herman Whitfield III. Herman Whitfield was killed by Indianapolis police. Neely was killed by another passenger on the subway. Both were tried, and all of them were acquitted. Stay with us. The award-winning piano virtuoso Herman Whitfield III playing one of his own compositions on the piano. He was killed by police while experiencing a mental health crisis. We'll talk more about his case later in the segment. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We look now at the tragic deaths of two black men who died while experiencing mental health crises. Both of these stories contain graphic descriptions of violence. We begin here in New York, where protests are continuing after a jury Monday acquitted subway vigilante Daniel Penny in the chokehold death of the street performer Jordan Neely on a Manhattan subway train last May, finding Penny not guilty of criminally negligent homicide. Neely was just 30 years old and a beloved Michael Jackson impersonator. He was unhoused. He was hungry. He was crying out for help when Penny, a white former U.S. Marine, attacked him, pinned him down on a subway train by the neck for 6 minutes. Neely's family has separately filed a civil lawsuit against Penny. Neely's father, Andre Zachary, was removed from the New York courtroom Monday after protesting the not guilty verdict, along with others. Zachary spoke from outside the courthouse.
I miss my son. My son didn't have to go through this. I didn't have to go through this either. It hurts. Really, really hurts. What are we going to do, people? What's going to happen to us now? I had enough of this. The system is rigged.
Mm-hmm.
Come on, people. Let's do something about this.
For more, we're joined by Christopher Neely, uncle of Jordan Neely. He was in the courtroom during parts of the trial. Thank you so much for being with us, Christopher. Our deepest condolences on the loss of your nephew. And I'm so sorry that as you were in the courtroom, you had to see over and over again what happened to your nephew.
Yes.
Can you share your reaction to the verdict?
I was totally taken aback. It was very hurtful. It was so unexpected. Friday, before the judge sent the jury away for the weekend to tell them to have a good weekend and think on their verdict, we had people in the jury fighting for Jordan Neely. They were fighting for him. People believed that Jordan Neely should have been alive today. A lot of people did.
Tell us about who Jordan was. I know you brought something that is very precious to you, that
yes.
was precious to Jordan.
Yes. Jordan, first of all, he was my sister's son. He stayed with me and my sister. We grew up in the house together. He was just a wonderful kid. He loved sports. He loved art. He loved to dance. And he loved to play chess. Like, I've been a chess player for a long time, and on my free time, I would play with him, and he really enjoyed the game. He liked to dress up. He always liked to look in the mirror and dance with the microphone, get his colors, anything shiny, anything shiny.
You brought a Michael Jackson jacket?
Yes.
Can you show us?
Yes, I did. This is a remake that that I
wow.
had got Jordan when he was maybe 25. I think he wore like two or three times, maybe. My mother kept it in the house. This is off the, I got this made off the Michael Jackson soundtrack, Leave Me Alone. At the end of the video, this is the jacket that he had on.
You can hold it up.
Sure.
Wow. So for our radio listeners, Christopher's holding up this gold, red, and black, what you definitely identify with Michael Jackson jacket.
Yes. Yes, these are the buttons. It took a while to get it done, but they did a great job, I think. This is the back of it.
Mm.
I loved it. It fit him perfectly.
Many New Yorkers, when Jordan died, shared videos of Jordan performing as Michael Jackson.
Yes.
He was very well recognized. You, Christopher, as Jordan's uncle, would go around the city looking for him sometimes. Is that right?
Subway stops,
bus stops?
That's correct. Anywhere I can find him, the bus terminal, wherever I think he might be, like if it's cold, where he might be at or whatever the case might be, especially when I found out that he was smoking weed. That was the first thing I found out about him. He was smoking weed. So I wanted to get on him about that and staying strong and just, like, you know, coming home.
Can you talk about how the police dealt with what happened? How the police dealt with the man who killed your nephew? And what happened on that day? What you came to understand?
It was buddy-buddy. I mean, when you look at the interview, it seems like they were buddy-buddy. They were leading him into finding out what occurred, but after they found out what occurred and they knew that he was dead, they still treated him like buddy-buddy. You know, he was a Marine. The officer was an ex-Marine, ex-military. He treated him like he was his friend, his buddy or pal. No handcuffs, no nothing. It's just unheard of.
We're talking about Daniel Penny, ex-Marine. Very different than what happened just in this last week as we witnessed this nationwide manhunt.
Yes.
Against the killer of Brian Thompson, the CEO
that didn't
of United Healthcare.
The Jordan Neely case at all. They actually let him go. They let him go.
They let Daniel Penny go.
Yeah, we had to fight for justice.
He put him in a chokehold, even when passengers... He said that he was defending the other passengers from your nephew.
Correct.
Many passengers were saying, let him go.
Right. A lot of passengers, if you listen on the video, a lot of passengers saying, if you keep holding on to him, he will die. You know, you had a guy that called his wife that was from the military that was just giving him some advice on what to tell the guy that was holding his hand. And nobody listened. Nobody listened.
Has the mayor's office, has Mayor Adams, who is a former police officer himself, has he reached out to you and to your family?
Not at all. He didn't come to the funeral, the wake. He didn't. All he's been saying is, justice was served for the city, especially after the verdict. I mean, everybody heard him. I'm not even giving too much attention to Eric Adams. He's just, to me, just a straight creep.
So, right now there's a lawsuit against Daniel Penny by his father, Andre Zachary.
Correct.
And how else are you moving forward?
Oh, any way possible. Like the way it was done, like this, just the trial, I really appreciate the prosecutors. I really appreciate everybody that helped. But I want to move forward in a way to where hopefully I can get the federal government involved somehow, some way. That trial just was ridiculous. I've never seen anything like that. You know, you got a top charge. They take the top charge off. Without even letting anybody from the family know about that and try to get him on criminal neglect, homicide. And then that didn't work. And then when you ask the district attorney about how much time he would get if he was to get convicted, from the beginning, when this first started, for me, I was involved deeply with the district attorney's office and trying to find out what time is he going to get if he gets convicted. They told me 19 years. For manslaughter in the second degree, which is the max, and criminal neglect homicide, the maximum is 5 years. I said, well, how much would he get on the top charge? They told me, I don't think he might do a year or two, or he might get probation. So if that's the case, how much is he going to get for criminal neglect homicide? Oh, he's not going to do no time. So I already knew from the beginning that he was probably going to do no time. So this here, I was just hoping and praying that we would get some justice, but we didn't get no justice.
This was Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg's office.
Correct.
We're going to continue to follow this case. Christopher Neely, uncle of Jordan Neely, thank you so much for joining us again. Our condolences to your family. This is Democracy Now! As we continue to look at the death of these two men. We just were talking about Jordan Neely. Now we're going to look at the death of the award-winning piano virtuoso Herman Whitfield III. It's another tragic story of a black man who was killed while experiencing a mental health crisis. A warning, this segment contains graphic descriptions of violence. On Friday, two Indianapolis police officers were acquitted in his 2022 killing. Herman Whitfield III died after the officers repeatedly tased him, handcuffed, pinned him to the ground as he cried out he could not breathe. He's shouting, "I cannot breathe." The jury found the officers Adam Ahmed and Steven Sanchez not guilty on all counts of involuntary manslaughter, reckless homicide, and battery. In April 2022, Whitfield's parents called 911 to ask for help, as their son experienced a mental health crisis in their home. The officers found Whitfield without clothes on, bleeding from the mouth. Instead of helping him, they attacked the 39-year-old with a stun gun, then restrained him. Whitfield's death was later ruled a homicide. On Tuesday, Democracy Now! Reached out to Whitfield's father, Herman Whitfield Jr., who talked about his son's love of music.
He was around 6 years old. He started composing and he started playing piano at four. So I would just like for him to be remembered that way. Just a wonderful person. Early in his career, he went to nursing homes and played for people, and always talkative, informative, and a very healing person to talk to. And as the world goes on, his music will probably be played, and I'm sure the world would realize how they would miss him too. And not to be able to see his potential in full is probably one of the saddest parts of this whole process. Not to see his full potential and the things that he could have probably done in the future.
That was Herman Whitfield Jr., the father of Herman Whitfield III, who died in 2022 after two Indianapolis officers repeatedly tased him, handcuffed, and pinned him to the ground as he cried out he couldn't breathe. We're joined now by Herman's mother, Gladys Whitfield, a former public interest law attorney, current federal administrative law judge. Again, our condolences on the loss of your son, Gladys. If you can describe what happened that day, I mean, you're experiencing a mental health crisis of your son. What did you hope would happen that day, that an ambulance would come?
Yes, thank you. Good morning, and thank you for having me on your show and talking about our son. And I'm here to essentially speak on his behalf, since he can't speak for himself, and talk about how he was harmed and killed. But yes, I called 911 for an ambulance because Herman was having a mental health crisis. And I wanted the ambulance to come and take him to the hospital. And so instead of that happening, as you can see on the videos, the videos are all over the internet, the body cam videos, Herman was handled so roughly and dehumanized. I think that had to be part of their mindset, the officer's mindset, and ultimately killed him.
Can you talk about the trial and the acquittal of the two Indianapolis officers, Gladys Whitfield?
Well, the trial went on for 5 days. It started Monday, and the jury began deliberations on Friday. And that same day, Friday, the officers, or rather the jury, returned its verdicts of not guilty on all charges for both officers. And we were very disappointed. We thought the evidence showed beyond a reasonable doubt that the officers had acted, had violated the law and committed criminal acts and should be held accountable for what they did.
How do you want your son to be remembered? What do you think justice would look like?
I guess I'm reframing in my mind what I think justice would look like, because I thought justice would look like the officers being convicted and being held accountable for their actions. And I just want to say here that one of the officers, Ahmad, had already previously had a complaint filed against him for harming a civilian. And at that time, Mr. Ahmad was an officer in another part of Indiana called Hobart. And a complaint was filed in Lake County Court. The outcome of that complaint, that court complaint, I am not sure, but previous allegations have been made about Officer Ahmad when he has been performing police duties. But so at this point, because the jury found the defendants not guilty, justice would include that we be found, we get a favorable decision in the U.S. District Court in the Southern District of Indiana, where we had filed a complaint for the wrongful death of Herman. And also we have a state claim pending, my husband and I, for the infliction of emotional distress, because I don't know if you could see in that video, but Herman was killed in our home right in front of us. Mm. And it was so, so tragic and unexpected and unnecessary.
You're a judge, Gladys Whitfield. I'm wondering, in this last 30 seconds, when someone is dealing with a mental health crisis, what are they supposed to do?
Well, my understanding, based upon the complaints or the pleadings that have been filed in court and the depositions where the officers were deposed and asked about what proper procedure is in a case where an individual is having mental health crises, the officers are supposed to take time, try to negotiate, talk to the person, you know, use persuasion, and to just try to de-escalate.
Well, Judge also, Gladys Whitfield, we have to leave it there, but this is an issue we will continue to talk about. Gladys Whitfield is the mother of Herman Whitfield III, award-winning African-American piano virtuoso killed by Indianapolis police in 2022 after his parents called 911 to ask for help for their son experiencing a mental health crisis. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, Alternative Radio, hear Chalmers Johnson on Blowback, the Consequences of U.S. Foreign Policy. That's Alternative Radio, Wednesday afternoons at 4, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
CJSF 90.1 FM would like to remind listeners that the following program is a repeat broadcast.